Sifter for the ear.
News, interviews, reviews, cinema, TV, streaming.
Action. Hi, y'all. This is Jerry Williams, a.k.a. TV Jerry. 2024 marks the 30th year for the James River Film Festival, which features foreign, independent, and experimental films. It runs this year from April 11th through 14th and finishes up on the 20th at various venues all over town.
We shot in Morocco. Funny enough, we didn't shoot in a studio. We shot in an abandoned Club Med, so like a resort.
That was Yesseria Bustia talking about shooting one of her films in Morocco. She's a Moroccan-American filmmaker who teaches at VCU. She'll be showing three of her shorts at this year's festival on Sunday, April 14th at the VMFA. We're going to take a look at all three of her films on today's show.
Sifter, review of the week.
Three Body Problem on Netflix. David Benioff and D.B. Weiss created the phenomenally popular Game of Thrones. They've teamed up with Alexander Wu, who's best known for True Blood, for this new sci-fi drama. It's set around the world in various times, with a group of scientists trying to understand communications from an alien species. There is the inevitable threat, but no spoilers here. To capture the imagination, good science fiction movies must show something new, and this one does that. There are mind-boggling concepts and several impressive sequences. The Panama Canal scene is the most spectacular. This show holds lots of promise, but the last three episodes deteriorated into personal drama while the cool elements faded away. The ending leaves it all up in the air, literally, so it's imperative to commit to future episodes for any resolution. There was enough intriguing in this season, so I'm willing to see what happens, even though the momentum of the first season ended before the end. I gave Three Body Problem 3.5 out of 5 stars. Yosita, welcome to Sifter for the Ear.
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me. It's so fun to be here, and I'm so excited to chat with you.
Congratulations on being part of this year's 30th James River Film Festival. So how did you get involved? How did they call you and say, hey, we want you to put your movies in the festival?
I was actually volunteering for the festival last year just for fun and had such a good time. I got in touch with Mike Jones last year.
Footnote. Mike Jones is a longtime movie lover and film scholar and one of the founders of the James River Film Festival.
And we stayed in touch throughout the year, and he reached out in the beginning of 2024 asking if I had any films that he could watch. And I sent them three short films I have. And he was like, you know, we'd really love to include this in our program this year. Would you be interested? And I said, absolutely. But Mike Jones was actually my professor way back in the day when I was, when I was a VCU cinema student.
Let's back up. You were born in Morocco. How did you get interested in movies? And then how did you get to the States?
My family and I would always vacation in the States when I was young. It was my mom's dream to live here. She had gone to grad school here. She went to George Washington. And so every year she would put her name and my father's name in the green card lottery. One year, we were in my aunt's house in Arlington. And we got a call from a friend who was basically checking on our mail saying, you know, you got a letter from the Department of State. It says here that you won the green card lottery. And so that moment really changed everything, because then we had to stay here. Or if we left, then we would have lost our green card lottery. She and my father made the decision to stay. And that was, yeah, it was summer of 1995. So it was such a quick change.
And I think you mentioned your father. I think he had something to do with getting you interested in movies in the first place, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. My dad is such a big enthusiast of films and movies. And I just grew up watching him watch films and joining him. He loved, you know, American films, but he also loved like the French New Wave and French cinema. And so I don't know, something about it just felt so magical to me. And I would just sit and let the music kind of overwhelm me and the images. And I also realized there's something not only magical, but just the universality of the language at play. Like anyone could just sit and understand what's going on screen. You don't even need dialogue. You can just connect emotionally. And that felt very powerful.
Oh, well, and so how did he respond? How did both of your parents respond when you said, I want to be a filmmaker?
I think my mom was a little, it took her some time to get used to it. My dad was really enthusiastic right from the start. And in fact, he still says, you know, I'm living out his dream. So he's really proud and really excited by it.
You had a dual major in psychology and cinema before you came to VCU. That's a weird combination. What was the reasoning behind those two things?
We were really encouraged to get a double major. I decided to go with psychology because, again, I was just so fascinated by characters, and I felt like that was going to inform my writing as a screenwriter. I love the theories. I loved psychology so much, and I still do. And I think it still very much is interwoven with how I approach my writing, because it's always about character first and then plot later.
Well, speaking of that, let's talk about some of these characters that you've created. Which of the films we've got, Afri, I'm Selma, and Into the Void, which one came first?
I Am Selma came first. We shot it at the end of 2014, and then it was Into the Void, which was in 2019. And then Afri is a funny one because I shot it in 2016, but it took a while to finish.
That's the opening music for Afri.
Shot in Morocco in Ouarzazate. Ouarzazate is known as the gates of the desert. So it's a very dry climate. It's also known to be, you know, the Hollywood of North Africa in a lot of ways. So there's a big infrastructure. But funny enough, we didn't shoot in a studio. We shot in an abandoned, what was a Club Med, so like a resort.
Oh, and wow.
I had basically gone to Morocco with a script in hand. And this script was an adaptation, or more or less inspired by, an Isaac Asimov short story called Nightfall, about a world that's never experienced darkness before. And I thought I was gonna more or less stick to an adaptation of that, but instead I realized I could say and tell a story that was more specific to where I was, and that could be even more enriching. So put the script aside, and we then decided to find non-actors to work with, essentially improvise some of the scenes. So from that, we had a very skeletal outline of what was going to happen. But originally it was a story between a daughter and a father, and then became a story between a brother and a sister.
Were these real people or the actors?
They were real people. They were playing themselves. And we were casting based on who felt most comfortable in front of the camera and who could just be playful and just like follow our direction. We overshot. We had like almost over 8 hours of footage.
Wow. And the finished product's only like 10 minutes or something.
Yeah, it's only 10 minutes.
It's in black and white. What was that decision?
From the beginning, I wanted it to be black and white because I didn't want the image of Morocco to come through. I really wanted this extraterrestrial planetary environment to take over the film. And we start off with an image of two suns in the sky, again, for really the audience to suspend their disbelief.
I was going to ask you about those multiple suns up there.
Yeah, so it was really to kind of get the audience into this alternate reality that we're in.
And of course, there was that little kind of, I don't know if it's a surprise, it's not spoiling anything, but there was a little color before it got over.
There is a little color, yeah. So
it'll be a surprise. People have to see it to find out what. So one last question on that movie, and that is, where did you find that underground shelter? Was that part of the resort? That was pretty crazy.
Yeah. It was part of the resort. But it is not, in fact, an underground shelter. It is actually, it's a water tower. And so we just cheated it as an underground cave. But in fact, we had to go up a very steep, very narrow ladder in order for us to get into this water tower.
Oh, I bet that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
While we're in the black and white mode, let's switch over to Into the Void and start with this clip where the mother is making her presentation to the board while holding her infant son.
We can compare the result. We can take the preliminary test results. We can compare them to design a long-term study of larger-scale differential rotation curves and further, more extensive hypotheses could predict that the percentage of matter in space, while impossible to see compared to stars and planetary bodies, is in fact quite larger than initially expected, traveling outward from our universe indefinitely.
Where did you shoot that? You have that amazing house from the 50s.
Yes, yes, yes. So that was a museum home.
Oh, okay.
We shot this in Bergen, New Jersey, just outside of New York City. And this was really when I was studying at Columbia. So some of the scenes were also shot on campus at Columbia. So the lecture hall right. was on Columbia's campus. And of course, it's a period piece. You know, we're really trying to go for 1955. So that's where the black and white came into play.
So what was the inspiration, or where did you get the idea for this project?
So this story actually came to me from my producer, who was a co-writer on the script, Ciara Dahl. She had come across Vera Rubin's story and also came across some journal entries that she found and was just really moved by this woman who had faced so much adversity in terms of trying to get her work taken seriously in science. She was the first to discover early evidence for dark matter in her field. And so we really wanted to focus on her time at Cornell when she was still studying under Dr. Feynman. He was her mentor. When she was a new mother, a newlywed, and yet people were not really taking her work to the effect that they should have, where it was really groundbreaking at the time. So it's a really intimate portrait of who she was as a student, as a mother, as a wife, and what she had to do to get her work out there that has had an enormous impact in the science community.
I have to say one thing that nobody's going to get but me and a few other people my age. In the background, you had Bob and Ray on the radio.
Footnote.
Bob and Ray were a comedy duo whose career on radio and TV spanned 5 decades. How did you determine that? Was that just something you found in the museum and you thought, oh, nobody will get this but people who were raised in the 50s?
That was something we found in the museum.
Cool. And you had to work, let me rephrase that. You got to work with a baby. Was that one baby or did you have the luxury of twins?
That was one baby.
Yeah, okay.
And he was adorable.
Oh, you're lucky because I've been on sets where they haven't been adorable. So that's good. When she makes her presentation, was that actually realistic or was that fictionalized to make the point?
It was a bit fictionalized. I mean, she did have to take her child to one of her presentations.
Right.
But not to the effect of her actually carrying it. So some of that is dramatized just to get a more of an effect.
And
was humiliated. I will say that. She was humiliated in front of the committee.
I'm sure. Well, and where did you get that scientific jargon that she got to spout there? Was that just from one of her writings or did you talk to a scientist?
It was both. Some of it was from her own writing. I mean, but we had a science advisor on our project with us. And this project was also supported by the Sloan Foundation. So we got extra support from them just to make sure everything was really precise.
Surprise guest drop in.
Somebody wanted to drop in. Coleman, do y'all already know each other?
I don't believe we've met.
I don't think so.
Footnote.
Coleman Jennings is the treasurer and all around everything for the James River Film Festival. Today he's subbing for Mike Jones, who's out of town.
I'm here to talk a little bit about this year's festival and I guess a little bit about our history as well.
It's the 30th year, so that's really cool.
That's right. It's our 30th year. You know, we first started out in 1994, originally sponsored by BCU's Art and History Department and Photo Film. And then that went so well the first year and later on it was formed into our own little nonprofit, and we merged with James Parrish, who was doing a lot of Flickr programming.
Right.
And now we are the James River Film Society, an actual 501c3 nonprofit that every year we put on the James River Film Festival, as well as many other events throughout the year, and co-sponsoring events as well.
And so what's exciting about this year, other than obviously the films that we're talking about now, but what else is exciting about the festival coming up this year?
Well, as you said, it is our 30th, so we're really excited about that, and we're trying to bring that kind of party attitude to everything. We pride ourselves on having, you know, events for everybody, or at least try to, right? Our events are free, and so we bring that to the public, as well as we like to focus on kind of more obscure auteur cinema, as well as experimental. We do a lot of music oriented screenings and things that might not otherwise get a screening in Richmond or otherwise, and just trying to bring something different to the people right. for Richmond, because Richmond is such a wild and diverse city that, you know, we're just trying to match that vibe, you know.
And Jeff Rohl will be back doing his special event.
Yes, yes. So Jeff Rohl, who was with us for many great years, has decided to bring back a much celebrated event of his filmmaker forums he does. We'll be holding that on Thursday, April 11th at 8 p.m. at Studio 23. He'll be having some filmmakers, local filmmakers, showing some of their work. And then you can stick around after and pick their brains and kind of just, you know, it's one thing to see a movie, but to be able to discuss it intimately with the director right after you view it is something that's special, I think.
I'll just have to mention he was on the podcast about 2 weeks ago with Cinema Niche, the other group mm-hmm. that he's involved in. Coleman, this is an important question that I have to ask you right up front. Were you alive 30 years ago?
Barely. I was born in 92, so I was not quite two in 94 when the first event happened. But yeah, so I was technically alive, but I wasn't really into movies then as much as I am now, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you do in the festival? I know you have all kind of responsibilities.
You know, our organization is pretty small and we wear a lot of hats. I guess my official title is treasurer, but I feel like I do a whole lot more. Personally, you know, I try to keep tabs on the website and, you know, I help with programming when I can. But I'm more the behind the scenes guy, but you'll see me at almost every event kind of helping out where I can, whether it's selling tickets or, you know, just right. kind of corral the chaos. But yeah, it's something I've been doing ever since I was at VCU. And Michael Jones was one of my professors and kind of got me into helping with the James River Film Society. And I just kind of kept doing it. You know, it's just one of those things that you meet a really lot of great people at these events, and we just have some of the best crowds that come out, and everybody is so passionate that it just feels like it's a real big community right, thing right. for me.
Well, that's interesting because Yesetta mentioned earlier that she actually got her first introduction from Mike Jones when he was a teacher for her. So it's kind of neat, that circle there. He just sucks everybody
oh, yeah.
in. Get them in the festival. Get them involved.
I mean, I would say that his classes at VCU were definitely what sparked my interest in film beyond a casual entertainment. Wow. You know, I took one of his classes and I just kept taking his classes. And, you know, I really learned to grow and appreciate film beyond just an entertainment medium. And I think it's unfortunate he's not here, but, you know, he was directly responsible for that. I've really enjoyed my time with the festival and just getting to meet so many amazing people who are just so passionate.
Well, we want to thank you for dropping in and giving us a little information on the festival. But I will be on vacation, so I'm going to miss seeing you this year, Coleman. But thanks for dropping in now.
Oh, thank you. Let me just say real quick, it's the 30th. It's April 11th through 14th and also on the 20th. And you can find more info at jamesriverfilm.org.
And there will be a link on the web page for the show, obviously, too.
Awesome. Thanks so much, y'all. Have a good rest of your show.
Okay. Thank you, Coleman.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The film that's the most interesting of the three, maybe it's because it's the most approachable and it has a great punchline, I'll have to say that, I Am Selma. First, let's listen to a clip where Selma is confronting her Muslim friend about wearing her headscarf to school.
Why don't you ever wear your scarf?
My scarf.
Is it because you think you're too cool for it? Your boyfriend won't like it?
Because it's a personal choice.
Was that semi-autobiographical? Was that something that happened to you?
A lot of people ask me that. I mean, it's not in a very exact way autobiographical, meaning I didn't face exactly the same things that Selma in the film had faced. But definitely, you know, growing up in suburb of D.C., right in the midst of, you know, post-9/11, there was a lot of questions about identity, about my own identity, and about what was tolerable at the time and what I could say and who I could say I was and who I could say I wasn't. And so all those questions really mixed me up a lot when yeah. I was growing up. And this film came out of a way to really reconcile what felt like clashing identities, dual identities, being American, being Muslim, being an Arab speaker, being North African, all these things that felt like they couldn't coexist, but of course they can, right? And in the film, the main character is a rather very bold adolescent girl who very much stays true to her identity and stays true to her spirituality as well and her devotion to her religion. And in the end, it's about that boldness really making an impact, a ripple impact on the people around her, because she's not backing down from who she is.
And where did you shoot that? In a high school somewhere, I am assuming.
I shot it in Northern Virginia. Some of it was at my friend's house, but basically the area where I grew up, where I was a teenager, some of it in my friend's house, some of it from my parents' home. And then there was a Lorton Arts Center that we shot that as the high school.
Uh-huh. And was the surprise ending your idea? Did that come up immediately, or was that, did you start with that, or did you say, oh, that would be a great way to finish it?
No, that came actually later in the rewriting. I have to pay credit to one of my producers, John Bowers, who really brought forth this idea for the ending, and it just made total sense. And it was, as you said, it's a great punchline.
Can you tell me what the ending was before that?
I don't remember.
Well, it's such a good one. I don't blame you. Well, that's good that you gave somebody else the credit. So you've done these three shorts at least. Do you have on the horizon the desire to do a feature?
I do. I'm currently working on a psychological thriller at the moment about a young woman who is haunted by her own doppelganger ghost and has to travel to Morocco to try to make sense of this ghost, these visions that she's having, and ultimately reconnect with her past.
Oh, wow. And so you'll be at the festival. You're going to be there to talk about each of them. Are you going to show the first one and then talk about it, and show the second one and then talk about it, and show the third one? Are you going to do them all three and then talk about it?
I think it's going to be all three and then a Q&A in the end.
Okay, great. One last question I always like to ask everybody. When you're not working at VCU, what do you like to watch?
Okay, right now I just saw Zone of Interest, and it was amazing, spectacular. Really, really loved it. Just so impactful. To be honest, I haven't made my way to the theater recently, but I'm trying to keep up with what's playing at Movieland. But that's the latest I've seen, and I just absolutely loved it.
I don't know if absolutely loved is the right expression for that movie, because it's kind of heavy and intense, but appreciated it. For sure.
Yeah. Appreciated it, for sure. Yeah.
All right. Well, then I want to thank you so much for doing this. Unfortunately, as I told you, I won't be able to be there, but we got a lot of good information from here. So we'll see what else you can come up with at the Q&A.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Yesaria will be screening these films as part of the James River Film Festival on Sunday, April 14th at the VMFA. And I'll have a link to the 30th Festival, which runs from April 11th through 20th, on the webpage for this show at tvjerry.com.
Coming soon. In theaters.
The First Omen. An American woman is sent to Rome to start a new life as a nun, but encounters the darkness that includes a conspiracy to bring about the birth of evil incarnate. Monkey Man. Dev Patel gets in shape as the titular character who unleashes vengeance on the corrupt leaders who killed his mother and victimized the poor. Patel also directed, with Jordan Peele producing. Wicked Little Letters. In a small English village, a conservative woman, Olivia Colman, starts receiving letters full of profanity, and she suspects her neighbor, Jesse Buckley. Dog Man. From French action director Luc Besson comes this action flick starring Caleb Landry Jones and plenty of dogs. Model House. The models are actually fashion models who are terrified by intruders.
TV and streaming.
Star Trek Discovery on Paramount Plus enters its final season. Mary and George on Stars. Julianne Moore plays the Countess of Buckingham, who grooms her son to seduce the king. I Woke Up a Vampire on Netflix. A teen discovers her nude blood-sucking heritage on her 13th birthday. Ishura on Hulu. Demigods have inherited the world after the demon king dies, and the battles for power begin. Scoop on Netflix. Gillian Anderson plays the reporter who interviewed Prince Andrew about his connection with Jeffrey Epstein. American Horror Story, Delicate, on Hulu and FX. The second half dropped on April 3rd, and the first half was so boring I forgot all about it. Girl State, on Apple. 500 girls from Missouri come together for a week-long lab in democracy, a follow-up to the similar Boys State from 2020. Monsters at Work on Disney Plus. Mechanic Tyler Tuskman tries to work his way up to the laugh floor. Loot on Apple, a new season of the comedy about the very rich woman, starring Maya Rudolph. I'll be skipping podcasts for the next 2 weeks to take a vacation, and I'll be back on the 24th with an interview with another foreign director who's now in the U.S. and will screen his feature at the ICA in April. This is Jerry Williams. Thanks for listening.
For more Sifter, including literally thousands of reviews,
visit tvjerry.com.
That's a wrap.